brush and comb left on the dressing-table, for all the world as if she expected to come back tomorrow. She had died very sudden at the end, they said. And once they had been coming, but had put off coming, what with the war and travel being so difficult these days, they had never come all these years, just sent her money, but never wrote, never came, and expected to find things as they had left them. Ah, dear! Why, the dressing-table drawers were full of things. She pulled them open. Handkerchiefs, bits of ribbon. Yes, she could see Mrs. Ramsay as she came up the drive with the washing. "Good evening, Mrs. McNab," she would say. She had a pleasant way with her. The girls all liked her. But, dear, many things had changed since then. She shut the drawer. Many families had lost their dearest. So she was dead, and Mr. Andrew killed, and Miss Prue dead too, they said, with her first baby. But everyone had lost someone these years. Prices had gone up shamefully, and didn't come down again, neither. She could well remember her in her grey cloak. "Good evening, Mrs. McNab," she said, and told cook to keep a plate of milk soup for her. Quite thought she wanted it, carrying that heavy basket all the way up from town. She could see her now, stooping over her flowers, and faint and flickering, like a yellow beam or the circle at the end of a telescope, a lady in a grey cloak, stooping over her flowers, went wandering over the bedroom wall, up the dressing-table, across the washstand, as Mrs. McNab hobbled and ambled, dusting, straightening. And cook's name now, Mildred, Marion, some name like that. Ah, she had forgotten. She did forget things. Fiery, like all red-haired women. Many a laugh they had had. She was always welcome in the kitchen. She made them laugh, she did. Things were better than now. She sighed. There was too much work for one woman. She wagged her head this side and that. This had been the nursery. Why, it was all damp in here. The plaster was falling. Whatever did they want to hang a beast's skull there? Gone mouldy, too. And rats in all the attics. The rain came in. But they never sent, never came. Some of the locks had gone, so the doors banged. She didn't like to be up here at dusk alone, neither. It was too much for one woman. Too much, too much. She creaked. She moaned. She banged the door. She turned the key in the lock, and left the house alone, shut up, locked. Chapter 9. The house was left. The house was deserted. It was left like a shell on a sandhill to fill with dry salt grains now that life had left it. The long night seemed to have set in. The trifling airs nibbling, the clammy breaths fumbling, seemed to have triumphed. The saucepan had rusted and the mat decayed. Toads had nosed their way in. Idly, aimlessly, the swaying shawl swung to and fro. A thistle thrust itself between the tiles in the larder. The swallows nested in the drawing-room. The floor was strewn with straw. The plaster fell in shovelfuls. Rafters were laid bare. Rats carried off this and that to gnaw behind the wainscots. Tortoiseshell butterflies burst from the chrysalis and pattered their life out on the window-pane. Poppies sowed themselves among the dahlias. The lawn waved with long grass. Giant artichokes towered among roses. A fringed carnation flowered among the cabbages, while the gentle tapping of a weed at the window had become, on winter's nights, a drumming from sturdy trees and thorned briars which made the whole room green in summer. What power could now prevent the fertility, the insensibility of nature? Mrs. McNab's dream of a lady, of a child, of a plate of milk soup? It had wavered over the walls like a spot of sunlight and vanished. She had locked the door. She had gone. It was beyond the strength of one woman, she said. They never sent. They never wrote. There were things up there rotting in the drawers. It was a shame to leave them so, she said. The place was gone to rack and ruin. Only the lighthouse beam entered the rooms for a moment, sent its sudden stare over bed and wall in the darkness of winter, looked with equanimity at the thistle and the swallow, the rat and the straw. Nothing now withstood them, nothing said no to them. Let the wind blow, let the poppy seed itself and the carnation mate with the cabbage, let the swallow build in the drawing-room, and the thistle thrust aside the tiles, and the butterfly sun itself on the faded chintz of the armchairs. Let the broken glass and the china lie out on the lawn and be tangled over with grass and wild berries. For now had come that moment, that hesitation when dawn trembles and night pauses, when, if a feather alight in the scale, it will be weighed down. One feather, and the house, sinking, falling, would have turned and pitched downwards to the depths of darkness. In the ruined room picnickers would have lit their kettles, lovers sought shelter there, lying on the bare boards, and the shepherd stored his dinner on the bricks, and the tramp slept with his coat round him to ward off the cold. Then the roof would have fallen, briars and hemlocks would have blotted out path, step, and window, would have grown unequally but lustily over the mound, until some trespasser, losing his way, could have told only by a red-hot poker among the nettles, or a scrap of china in the hemlock, that here, once, someone had lived, there had been a house. If the feather had fallen, if it had tipped the scale downwards, the whole house would have plunged to the depths to lie upon the sands of oblivion. But there was a force working, something not highly conscious, something that leered, something that lurched, something not inspired to go about its work with dignified ritual or solemn chanting. Mrs. McNab groaned. Mrs. Bast creaked. They were old, they were stiff, their legs ached. They came with their brooms and pails at last. They got to work. All of a sudden, would Mrs. McNab see that the house was ready, one of the young ladies wrote, would she get this done, would she get that done, all in a hurry? They might be coming for the summer, had left everything to the last, expected to find things as they had left them. Slowly and painfully, with broom and pail, mopping, scouring, Mrs. McNab, Mrs. Bast, stayed the corruption and the rot, rescued from the pool of time that was fast closing over them, now a basin, now a cupboard, fetched up from oblivion all the Waverley novels and a tea-set one morning, in the afternoon restored to sun and air a brass fender and a set of steel fire-irons. George, Mrs. Bast's son, caught the rats and cut the grass. They had the builders. Attended with the creaking of hinges and the screeching of bolts, the slamming and banging of damp-swollen woodwork, some rusty, laborious birth seemed to be taking place, as the women, stooping, rising, groaning, singing, slapped and slammed, upstairs now, now down in the cellars. Oh, they said, the work! They drank their tea in the bedroom sometimes, or in the study, breaking off work at midday with the smudge on their faces, and their old hands clasped and cramped with the broom-handles. Flopped on chairs, they contemplated, now the magnificent conquest over taps and bath, now the more arduous, more partial triumph over long rows of books, black as ravens once, now white-stained, breeding pale mushrooms and secreting furtive spiders. Once more, as she felt the tea warm in her, the telescope fitted itself to Mrs. McNab's eyes, and in a ring of light she saw the old gentleman, lean as a rake, wagging his head, as she came up with the washing. Talking to himself, she supposed, on the lawn. He never noticed her. Some said he was dead, some said she was dead. Which was it? Mrs. Bast didn't know for certain either. The young gentleman was dead. That she was sure. She had read his name in the papers. There was the cook now, Mildred, Marion, some such name as that, a red-headed woman, quick-tempered like all her sort, but kind, too, if you knew the way with her. Many a laugh they had had together. She saved a plate of soup for Maggie, a bite of ham sometimes, whatever was over. They lived well in those days. They had everything they wanted. Glibly, jovially, with the tea hot in her, she unwound her ball of memories, sitting in the wicker armchair by the nursery fender. There was always plenty doing, people in the house, 20 staying sometimes, and washing up till long past midnight. Mrs. Bast, she had never known them, had lived in Glasgow at that time, wondered, putting her cup down, whatever they hung that beast's skull there for. Shot in foreign parts, no doubt. It might well be, said Mrs. McNab, wantoning on with her memories. They had friends in eastern countries, gentlemen staying there, ladies in evening dress. She had seen them once through the dining-room door, all sitting at dinner. 20, she dared say, all in their jewellery, and she asked to stay help wash up, might be till after midnight. Ah, said Mrs. Bast, they'd find it changed. She leant out of the window. She watched her son George scything the grass. They might well ask what had been done to it, seeing how old Kennedy was supposed to have charge of it, and then his leg got so bad after he fell from the cart, and then perhaps no one for a year, or the better part of one, and then Davy MacDonald, and seeds might be sent, but who should say if they were ever planted? They'd find it changed. She watched her son scything. He was a great one for work, one of those quiet ones. Well, they must be getting along with the cupboards, she supposed. They hauled themselves up. At last, after days of labour within, of cutting and digging without, dusters were flicked from the windows were shut to, keys were turned all over the house, the front door was banged, it was finished. And now, as if the cleaning and the scrubbing and the scything and the mowing had drowned it, there rose that half-heard melody, that intermittent music which the ear half catches but lets fall, a bark, a bleat, irregular, intermittent yet somehow related, the hum of an insect, the tremor of cut grass, dissevered yet somehow belonging, the jar of a door-beetle, the squeak of a wheel, loud, low but mysteriously related, which the ear strains to bring together, and is always on the verge of harmonizing, but they are never quite heard, never fully harmonized, and at last, in the evening, one after another the sounds die out, and the harmony falters and silence falls. With the sunset, sharpness was lost, and, like mist rising, quiet rose, quiet spread, the wind settled. Loosely the world shook itself down to sleep. Darkly here, without a light to it, save what came green suffused through leaves, or pale on the white flowers in the bed by the window. Lily Briscoe had her bag carried up to the house late one evening in September. Mr. Carmichael came by the same train. Chapter 10. Then, indeed, peace had come. Messages of peace breathed from the sea to the shore. Never to break its sleep any more, to lull it rather more deeply to rest, and whatever the dreamers dreamt holily, dreamt wisely, to confirm. What else was it murmuring, as Lily Briscoe laid her head on the pillow in the clean, still room and heard the sea? Through the open window the voice of the beauty of the world came murmuring, too softly to hear exactly what it said, but what mattered if the meaning were plain, entreating the sleepers. The house was full again, Mrs. Beckwith was staying there, also Mr. Carmichael. If they would not actually come down to the beach itself, at least to lift the blind and look out. They would see then night flowing down in purple, his head crowned, his sceptre jewelled, and how in his eyes a child might look. And if they still faltered, Lily was tired out with travelling and slept almost at once, but Mr. Carmichael read a book by candlelight. If they still said no, that it was vapour, this splendour of his, and that the dew had more power than he, and they preferred sleeping. Gently then, without complaint or argument, the voice would sing its song. Gently the waves would break. Lily heard them in her sleep. Tenderly the light fell. It seemed to come through her eyelids. And it all looked, Mr. Carmichael thought, shutting his book, falling asleep, much as it used to look. Indeed, the voice might resume, as the curtains of dark wrapped themselves over the house, over Mrs. Beckwith, Mr. Carmichael, and Lily Briscoe, so that they lay with several folds of blackness on their eyes. Why not accept this, be content with this, acquiesce and resign? The sigh of all the seas breaking in measure round the isles soothed them. The night wrapped them. Nothing broke their sleep, until, the birds beginning and the dawn weaving their thin voices into its whiteness, a cart grinding, a dog somewhere barking, the sun lifted the curtains, broke the veil on their eyes, and Lily Briscoe stirring in her sleep. She clutched at her blankets as a faller clutches at the turf on the edge of a cliff. Her eyes opened wide. Here she was again, she thought, sitting bolt upright in bed. Awake. End of section 11. Section 12 of To the Lighthouse by Virginia Woolf. Part 3. The Lighthouse. Chapter 1. What does it mean, then? What can it all mean? Lily Briscoe asked herself, wondering whether, since she had been left alone, it behoved her to go to the kitchen to fetch another cup of coffee or wait here. What does it mean? A catchword that was, caught up from some book, fitting her thought loosely, for she could not, this first morning with the Ramsays, contract her feelings, could only make a phrase resound to cover the blankness of her mind until these vapours had shrunk. For really, what did she feel, come back after all these years and Mrs. Ramsay dead? Nothing, nothing, nothing that she could express at all. She had come late last night, when it was all mysterious, dark. Now she was awake, at her old place at the breakfast-table, but alone. It was very early, too, not yet 8. There was this expedition. They were going to the lighthouse, Mr. Ramsay, Cam, and James. They should have gone already. They had to catch the tide or something. And Cam was not ready, and James was not ready, and Nancy had forgotten to order the sandwiches, and Mr. Ramsay had lost his temper and banged out of the room. "What's the use of going now?" he had stormed. Nancy had vanished. There he was, marching up and down the terrace in a rage. One seemed to hear doors slamming and voices calling all over the house. Now Nancy burst in and asked, looking round the room, in a queer, half-dazed, half-desperate way, "What does one send to the lighthouse?" As if she were forcing herself to do what she despaired of ever being able to do. What does one send to the lighthouse, indeed? At any other time, Lily could have suggested reasonably tea, tobacco, newspapers. But this morning everything seemed so extraordinarily queer that a question like Nancy's, "What does one send to the lighthouse?" opened doors in one's mind that went banging and swinging to and fro, and made one keep asking, in a stupefied gape, what does one send? What does one do? Why is one sitting here, after all? Sitting alone, for Nancy went out again, among the clean cups at the long table, she felt cut off from other people, and able only to go on watching, asking, wondering. The house, the place, the morning, all seemed strangers to her. She had no attachment here, she felt, no relations with it. Anything might happen, and whatever did happen, a step outside, a voice calling, "It's not in the cupboard, it's on the landing," someone cried, was a question, as if the link that usually bound things together had been cut, and they floated up here, down there, off, anyhow. How aimless it was, how chaotic, how unreal it was, she thought, looking at her empty coffee-cup. Mrs. Ramsay dead. Andrew killed. Prue dead, too. Repeat it as she might, it roused no feeling in her. "And we all get together in a house like this on a morning like this," she said, looking out of the window. It was a beautiful still day. Chapter 2. Suddenly Mr. Ramsay raised his head as he passed, and looked straight at her, with his distraught, wild gaze which was yet so penetrating, as if he saw you, for one second, for the first time, for ever. And she pretended to drink out of her empty coffee-cup, so as to escape him, to escape his demand on her, to put aside a moment longer that imperious need. And he shook his head at her, and strode on.
"Alone," she heard him say. "Perished," she heard him say.
And like everything else this strange morning, the words became symbols, wrote themselves all over the grey-green walls. If only she could put them together, she felt, write them out in some sentence, then she would have got at the truth of things. Old Mr. Carmichael came padding softly in, fetched his coffee, took his cup, and made off to sit in the sun. The extraordinary unreality was frightening, but it was also exciting. Going to the lighthouse. But what does one send to the lighthouse? Perished. Alone. The grey-green light on the wall opposite. The empty places. Such were some of the parts, but how bring them together? She asked. As if any interruption would break the frail shape she was building on the table, she turned her back to the window, lest Mr. Ramsay should see her. She must escape somewhere, be alone somewhere. Suddenly she remembered. When she had sat there last, 10 years ago, there had been a little sprig or leaf pattern on the tablecloth, which she had looked at in a moment of revelation. There had been a problem about a foreground of a picture. "Move the tree to the middle," she had said. She had never finished that picture. She would paint that picture now. It had been knocking about in her mind all these years. Where were her paints? She wondered. Her paints, yes. She had left them in the hall last night. She would start at once. She got up quickly, before Mr. Ramsay turned. She fetched herself a chair. She pitched her easel with her precise, old-maidish movements on the edge of the lawn, not too close to Mr. Carmichael, but close enough for his protection. Yes, it must have been precisely here that she had stood 10 years ago. There was the wall, the hedge, the tree. The question was of some relation between those masses. She had borne it in her mind all these years. It seemed as if the solution had come to her. She knew now what she wanted to do. But with Mr. Ramsay bearing down on her, she could do nothing. Every time he approached, he was walking up and down the terrace, ruin approached, chaos approached. She could not paint. She stooped. She turned. She took up this rag. She squeezed that tube. But all she did was to ward him off for a moment. He made it impossible for her to do anything. For if she gave him the least chance, if he saw her disengaged a moment, looking his way a moment, he would be on her, saying, as he had said last night, "You find us much changed." Last night he had got up and stopped before her, and said that. Dumb and staring though they had all sat, the 6 children whom they used to call after the kings and queens of England, the red, the fair, the wicked, the ruthless, she felt how they raged under it. Kind old Mrs. Beckwith said something sensible. But it was a house full of unrelated passions. She had felt that all the evening. And on top of this chaos, Mr. Ramsay got up, pressed her hand, and said, "You will find us much changed." And none of them had moved or had spoken, but had sat there as if they were forced to let him say it. Only James, certainly the sullen, scowled at the lamp, and Cam screwed her handkerchief round her finger. Then he reminded them that they were going to the lighthouse tomorrow. They must be ready, in the hall, on the stroke of 7:30. Then, with his hand on the door, he stopped. He turned upon them. Did they not want to go? He demanded. Had they dared say no? He had some reason for wanting it. He would have flung himself tragically backwards into the bitter waters of despair. Such a gift he had for gesture. He looked like a king in exile. Doggedly, James said yes. Cam stumbled more wretchedly. Yes, oh yes, they'd both be ready, they said. And it struck her, this was tragedy. Not Paul's, dust and the shroud, but children coerced, their spirits subdued. James was 16, Cam 17 perhaps. She had looked round for someone who was not there, for Mrs. Ramsay, presumably. But there was only kind Mrs. Beckwith, turning over her sketches under the lamp. Then, being tired, her mind still rising and falling with the sea, the taste and smell that places have after long absence possessing her, the candles wavering in her eyes, she had lost herself and gone under. It was a wonderful night, starlit. The waves sounded as they went upstairs. The moon surprised them, enormous, pale, as they passed the staircase window. She had slept at once. She set her clean canvas firmly upon the easel, as a barrier, frail, but she hoped sufficiently substantial to ward off Mr. Ramsay and his exactingness. She did her best to look, when his back was turned, at her picture, that line there, that mass there. But it was out of the question. Let him be 50 feet away, let him not even speak to you, let him not even see you. He permeated, he prevailed, he imposed himself. He changed everything. She could not see the colour, she could not see the lines. Even with his back turned to her, she could only think, but he'll be down on me in a moment, demanding. Something she felt she could not give him. She rejected one brush, she chose another. When would those children come? When would they all be off? She fidgeted. That man, she thought, her anger rising in her, never gave, that man took. She, on the other hand, would be forced to give. Mrs. Ramsay had given. Giving, 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 she had died, and had left all this. Really, she was angry with Mrs. Ramsay. With the brush slightly trembling in her fingers, she looked at the hedge, the step, the wall. It was all Mrs. Ramsay's doing. She was dead. Here was Lily, at 44, wasting her time, unable to do a thing, standing there, playing at painting, playing at the one thing one did not play at, and it was all Mrs. Ramsay's fault. She was dead. The step where she used to sit was empty. She was dead. But why repeat this over and over again? Why be always trying to bring up some feeling she had not got? There was a kind of blasphemy in it. It was all dry, all withered, all spent. They ought not to have asked her. She ought not to have come. One can't waste one's time at 44, she thought. She hated playing at painting. A brush, the one dependable thing in a world of strife, ruin, chaos, that one should not play with, knowingly even. She detested it. But he made her. You shan't touch your canvas, he seemed to say, bearing down on her, till you've given me what I want of you. Here he was, close upon her again, greedy, distraught. Well, thought Lily in despair, letting her right hand fall at her side. It would be simpler then to have it over. Surely she could imitate from recollection the glow, the rhapsody, the self-surrender she had seen on so many women's faces, on Mrs. Ramsay's, for instance, when on some occasion like this they blazed up. She could remember the look on Mrs. Ramsay's face, into a rapture of sympathy, of delight in the reward they had, which, though the reason of it escaped her, evidently conferred on them the most supreme bliss of which human nature was capable. Here he was, stopped by her side. She would give him what she could. Chapter 3. She seemed to have shrivelled slightly, he thought. She looked a little skimpy, wispy, but not unattractive. He liked her. There had been some talk of her marrying William Banks once, but nothing had come of it. his wife had been fond of her. He had been a little out of temper, too, at breakfast. And then... This was one of those moments when an enormous need urged him, without being conscious what it was, to approach any woman, to force them, he did not care how, his need was so great, to give him what he wanted, sympathy. Was anybody looking after her, he said? Had she everything she wanted?
Oh, thanks, everything, said Lily Briscoe nervously.
No, she could not do it. She ought to have floated off instantly upon some wave of sympathetic expansion. The pressure on her was tremendous. But she remained stuck. There was an awful pause. They both looked at the sea. Why, thought Mr. Ramsay, should she look at the sea when I am here? She hoped it would be calm enough for them to land at the lighthouse, she said. The lighthouse! The lighthouse! What's that got to do with it? He thought impatiently. Instantly, with the force of some primeval gust, for really he could not restrain himself any longer, there issued from him such a groan that any other woman in the whole world would have done something, said something. All except myself, thought Lily, girding at herself bitterly, who am not a woman, but a peevish, ill-tempered, dried-up old maid, presumably. Mr. Ramsay sighed to the full. He waited. Was she not going to say anything? Did she not see what he wanted from her? Then he said he had a particular reason for wanting to go to the lighthouse. His wife used to send the men things. There was a poor boy with a tuberculous hip, the lightkeeper's son. He sighed profoundly. He sighed significantly. All Lily wished was that this enormous flood of grief, this insatiable hunger for sympathy, this demand that she should surrender herself up to him entirely, and even so he had sorrows enough to keep her supplied for ever, should leave her, should be diverted. She kept looking at the house, hoping for an interruption, before it swept her down in its flow.
"Such expeditions," said Mr. Ramsay, scraping the ground with his toe, "are very painful."
Still Lily said nothing. "She is a stock, she is a stone," he said to himself.
"They are very exhausting," he said,
looking, with a sickly look that nauseated her. He was acting, she felt. This great man was dramatizing himself. At his beautiful hands. It was horrible. It was indecent. Would they never come, she asked, for she could not sustain this enormous weight of sorrow, support these heavy draperies of grief. He had assumed a pose of extreme decrepitude. He even tottered a little as he stood there, a moment longer. Still she could say nothing. The whole horizon seemed swept bare of objects to talk about. Could only feel, amazedly, as Mr. Ramsay stood there, how his gaze seemed to fall dolefully over the sunny grass and discolour it, and cast over the rubicund, drowsy, entirely contented figure of Mr. Carmichael, reading a French novel on a deck-chair. A veil of crape, as if such an existence, flaunting its prosperity in a world of woe, were enough to provoke the most dismal thoughts of all. "Look at him," he seemed to be saying. "Look at me." And indeed all the time he was feeling, "Think of me, think of me." Ah, could that bulk only be wafted alongside of them, Lily wished. Had she only pitched her easel a yard or two closer to him, a man, any man, would staunch this effusion, would stop these lamentations. A woman, she had provoked this horror. A woman, she should have known how to deal with it. It was immensely to her discredit, sexually, to stand there dumb. One said, what did one say? "Oh, Mr. Ramsay, dear Mr. Ramsay." That was what that kind old lady who sketched, Mrs. Beckwith, would have said, instantly and rightly. But no. They stood there, isolated from the rest of the world. His immense self-pity, his demand for sympathy poured and spread itself in pools at her feet, and all she did, miserable sinner that she was to draw her skirts a little closer round her ankles, lest she should get wet. In complete silence she stood there, grasping her paintbrush. Heaven could never be sufficiently praised. She heard sounds in the house. James and Cam must be coming. But Mr. Ramsay, as if he knew that his time ran short, exerted upon her solitary figure the immense pressure of his concentrated woe, his age, his frailty, his desolation, when suddenly, tossing his head impatiently, in his annoyance, for after all, what woman could resist him? He noticed that his bootlaces were untied. Remarkable boots they were, too, Lily thought, looking down at them. Sculptured, colossal, like everything that Mr. Ramsay wore, from his frayed tie to his half-buttoned waistcoat, his own indisputably. She could see them walking to his room of their own accord, expressive in his absence of pathos, surliness, ill-temper, charm. "What beautiful boots!" she exclaimed. She was ashamed of herself. To praise his boots when he asked her to solace his soul, when he had shown her his bleeding hands, his lacerated heart, and asked her to pity them, then to say, cheerfully, "Ah, but what beautiful boots you wear!" deserved, she knew, and she looked up expecting to get it in one of his sudden roars of ill-temper, complete annihilation. Instead, Mr. Ramsay smiled. His pall, his draperies, his infirmities fell from him. "Ah, yes," he said, holding his foot up for her to look at. "They were first-rate boots. There was only one man in England who could make boots like that." "Boots are among the chief curses of mankind," he said. "Bootmakers make it their business," he exclaimed, "to cripple and torture the human foot." "They are also the most obstinate and perverse of mankind. It had taken him the best part of his youth to get boots made as they should be made." He would have her observe, he lifted his right foot and then his left, that she had never seen boots made quite that shape before. They were made of the finest leather in the world also. Most leather was mere brown paper and cardboard. He looked complacently at his foot, still held in the air. They had reached, she felt, a sunny island where peace dwelt, sanity reigned, and the sun for ever shone, the blessed island of good boots. Her heart warmed to him. "Now let me see if you can tie a knot," he said. He pooh-poohed her feeble system. He showed her his own invention. Once you tied it, it never came undone. Three times he knotted her shoe, three times he unknotted it. Why, at this completely inappropriate moment, when he was stooping over her shoe, should she be so tormented with sympathy for him that, as she stooped too, the blood rushed to her face, and, thinking of her callousness, she had called him a play-actor, she felt her eyes swell and tingle with tears. Thus occupied, he seemed to her a figure of infinite pathos. He tied knots. He bought boots. There was no helping Mr. Ramsay on the journey he was going. But now, just as she wished to say something, could have said something, perhaps, here they were, Cam and James. They appeared on the terrace. They came lagging, side by side, a serious, melancholy couple. But why was it like that that they came? She could not help feeling annoyed with them. They might have come more cheerfully. They might have given him what, now that they were off, she would not have the chance of giving him. For she felt a sudden emptiness, a frustration. Her feeling had come too late. There it was, ready, but he no longer needed it. He had become a very distinguished, elderly man, who had no need of her whatsoever. She felt snubbed. He slung a knapsack round his shoulders. He shared out the parcels. There were a number of them,
ill-tied in brown paper. He sent Cam for a cloak. He had all the appearance of a leader making ready for an expedition. Then, wheeling about, he led the way with his firm military tread, in those wonderful boots, carrying brown paper parcels, down the path, his children following him. They looked, she thought, as if fate had devoted them to some stern enterprise, and they went to it, still young enough to be drawn acquiescent in their father's wake, obediently, but with a pallor in their eyes, which made her feel that they suffered something beyond their years in silence. So they passed the edge of the lawn, and it seemed to Lily that she watched a procession go by, drawn on by some stress of common feeling, which made it, faltering and flagging as it was, a little company bound together, and strangely impressive to her. Politely, but very distantly, Mr. Ramsay raised his hand and saluted her as they passed. But what a face, she thought, immediately finding the sympathy which she had not been asked to give, troubling her for expression. What had made it like that? Thinking, night after night, she supposed, about the reality of kitchen tables, she added, remembering the symbol which in her vagueness as to what Mr. Ramsay did think about, Andrew had given her. He had been killed by the splinter of a shell instantly, she bethought her. The kitchen table was something visionary, austere, something bare, hard, not ornamental. There was no colour to it, it was all edges and angles, it was uncompromisingly plain. But Mr. Ramsay kept always his eyes fixed upon it, never allowed himself to be distracted or deluded, until his face became worn too, and ascetic, and partook of this unornamented beauty which so deeply impressed her. Then she recalled, standing where he had left her, holding her brush, worries had fretted it, not so nobly. He must have had his doubts about that table, she supposed, whether the table was a real table, whether it was worth the time he gave to it, whether he was able, after all, to find it. He had had doubts, she felt, or he would have asked less of people. That was what they talked about late at night sometimes, she suspected, and then next day Mrs. Ramsay looked tired, and Lily flew into a rage with him over some absurd little thing. But now he had nobody to talk to about that table, or his boots, or his knots, and he was like a lion seeking whom he could devour, and his face had that touch of desperation, of exaggeration in it, which alarmed her, and made her pull her skirts about her. And then, she recalled, there was that sudden revivification, that sudden flare, when she praised his boots, that sudden recovery of vitality and interest in ordinary human things, which too passed and changed, for he was always changing and hid nothing, into that other final phase which was new to her, and had, she owned, made herself ashamed of her own irritability, when it seemed as if he had shed worries and ambitions, and the hope of sympathy and the desire for praise, had entered some other region, was drawn on, as if by curiosity, in dumb colloquy, whether with himself or another, at the head of that little procession out of one's range. An extraordinary face. The gate banged.
End of section 12. Section 13 of To the Lighthouse by Virginia Woolf.
Chapter 4. So they're gone, she thought, sighing with relief and disappointment. Her sympathy seemed to be cast back on her, like a bramble sprung across her face. She felt curiously divided, as if one part of her were drawn out there. It was a still day, hazy. The lighthouse looked this morning at an immense distance. The other had fixed itself doggedly, solidly, here on the lawn. She saw her canvas as if it had floated up and placed itself, white and uncompromising, directly before her. It seemed to rebuke her with its cold stare for all this hurry and agitation, this folly and waste of emotion. It drastically recalled her,
and spread through her mind, first a peace, as her disorderly sensations. He had gone, and she had been so sorry for him, and she had said nothing. Trooped off the field. And then emptiness. She looked blankly at the canvas, with its uncompromising white stare, from the canvas to the garden. There was something. She stood screwing up her little Chinese eyes in her small puckered face. Something she remembered in the relations of those lines cutting across, slicing down, and in the mass of the hedge with its green cave of blues and browns, which had stayed in her mind, which had tied a knot in her mind, so that at odds and ends of time, involuntarily, as she walked along the Brompton Road, as she brushed her hair, she found herself painting that picture, passing her eye over it, and untying the knot in imagination. But there was all the difference in the world between this planning airily away from the canvas, and actually taking her brush and making the first mark. She had taken the wrong brush in her agitation at Mr. Ramsay's presence, and her easel, rammed into the earth so nervously, was at the wrong angle. And now that she had put that right, and in so doing had subdued the impertinences and irrelevances that plucked her attention, and made her remember how she was such and such a person, had such and such relations to people, she took her hand and raised her brush. For a moment it stayed trembling, in a painful but exciting ecstasy in the air. Where to begin? That was the question, at what point to make the first mark. One line, placed on the canvas, committed her to innumerable risks, to frequent and irrevocable decisions. All that in idea seemed simple became in practice immediately complex, as the waves shape themselves symmetrically from the cliff-top, but to the swimmer among them are divided by steep gulfs and foaming crests. Still the risk must be run, the mark made. With a curious physical sensation, as if she were urged forward and at the same time must hold herself back, she made her first quick, decisive stroke. The brush descended. It flickered brown over the white canvas. It left a running mark. A second time she did it, a third time. And so pausing, and so flickering, she attained a dancing, rhythmical movement, as if the pauses were one part of the rhythm, and the strokes another, and all were related. And so, lightly and swiftly pausing, striking, she scored her canvas with brown running nervous lines, which had no sooner settled there than they enclosed. She felt it looming out at her, a space. Down in the hollow of one wave, she saw the next wave towering higher and higher above her. For what could be more formidable than that space? Here she was again, she thought, stepping back to look at it, drawn out of gossip, out of living, out of community with people, into the presence of this formidable ancient enemy of hers, this other thing, this truth, this reality, which suddenly laid hands on her, emerged stark at the back of appearances and commanded her attention. She was half unwilling, half reluctant. Why always be drawn out and haled away? Why not left in peace to talk to Mr. Carmichael on the lawn? It was an exacting form of intercourse, anyhow. Other worshipful objects were content with worship. Men, women, God, all let one kneel prostrate. But this form, were it only the shape of a white lampshade looming on a wicker table, roused one to perpetual combat, challenged one to a fight in which one was bound to be worsted. Always, it was in her nature, or in her sex, she did not know which, before she exchanged the fluidity of life for the concentration of painting, she had a few moments of nakedness, where she seemed like an unborn soul, a soul reft of body, hesitating on some windy pinnacle, and exposed without protection to all the blasts of doubt. Why, then, did she do it? She looked at the canvas, lightly scored with running lines. It would be hung in the servants' bedrooms. It would be rolled up and stuffed under a sofa. What was the good of doing it, then? And she heard some voice saying she couldn't paint, saying she couldn't create, as if she were caught up in one of those habitual currents, in which, after a certain time, experience forms in the mind, so that one repeats words without being aware any longer of who originally spoke them. "Can't paint, can't write," she murmured monotonously, anxiously considering what her plan of attack should be. For the mass loomed before her. It protruded. She felt it pressing on her eyeballs. Then, as if some juice necessary for the lubrication of her faculties were spontaneously squirted, she began precariously dipping among the blues and umbers, moving her brush hither and thither. But it was now heavier and went slower, as if it had fallen in with some rhythm which was dictated to her. She kept looking at the hedge, at the canvas. By what sheer rhythm was strong enough to bear her along with it on its current? Certainly she was losing consciousness of outer things. And as she lost consciousness of outer things, and her name and her personality and her appearance, and whether Mr. Carmichael was there or not, her mind kept throwing up from its depths scenes and names and sayings and memories and ideas, like a fountain spurting over that glaring, hideously difficult white space, while she modelled it with greens and blues. Charles Tansley used to say that, she remembered, women can't paint, can't write. Coming up behind her, he had stood close beside her, a thing she hated, as she painted here on this very spot.
"Shag tobacco," he said, "fivepence an ounce,"
parading his poverty, his principles. But the war had drawn the sting of her femininity. Poor devils, one thought, poor devils of both sexes. He was always carrying a book about under his arm, a purple book. He worked. He sat, she remembered, working in a blaze of sun. At dinner he would sit right in the middle of the view. But, after all, she reflected, there was the scene on the beach. One must remember that. It was a windy morning. They had all gone down to the beach. Mrs. Ramsay sat down and wrote letters by a rock. She wrote and wrote. "Oh," she said, looking up at something floating in the sea. "Is it a lobster pot? Is it an upturned boat?" She was so short-sighted that she could not see, and then Charles Tansley became as nice as he could possibly be. He began playing ducks and drakes. They chose little flat black stones and sent them skipping over the waves. Every now and then Mrs. Ramsay looked up over her spectacles and laughed at them. What they said she could not remember, but only she and Charles throwing stones, and getting on very well all of a sudden, and Mrs. Ramsay watching them. She was highly conscious of that. Mrs. Ramsay, she thought, stepping back and screwing up her eyes. It must have altered the design a good deal when she was sitting on the step with James. There must have been a shadow. When she thought of herself and Charles throwing ducks and drakes, and of the whole scene on the beach, it seemed to depend somehow upon Mrs. Ramsay sitting under the rock, with a pad on her knee, writing letters. She wrote innumerable letters, and sometimes the wind took them, and she and Charles just saved a page from the sea. But what a power was in the human soul, she thought. That woman sitting there, writing under the rock, resolved everything into simplicity, made these angers, irritations fall off like old rags. She brought together this and that, and then this, and so made out of that miserable silliness and spite. She and Charles squabbling, sparring, had been silly and spiteful. Something, this scene on the beach, for example, this moment of friendship and liking, which survived, after all these years complete, so that she dipped into it to refashion her memory of him, and there it stayed in the mind, affecting one almost like a work of art. "Like a work of art," she repeated, looking from her canvas to the drawing-room steps and back again. She must rest for a moment. And, resting, looking from one to the other vaguely, the old question which traversed the sky of the soul perpetually, the vast, the general question, which was apt to particularize itself at such moments as these, when she released faculties that had been on the strain, stood over her, paused over her, darkened over her. What is the meaning of life? That was all, a simple question, one that tended to close in on one with years. The great revelation had never come. The great revelation perhaps never did come. Instead, there were little daily miracles, illuminations, matches struck unexpectedly in the dark. Here was one. This, that, and the other. Herself and Charles Tansley and the breaking wave. Mrs. Ramsay bringing them together. Mrs. Ramsay saying, "Life stands still here." Mrs. Ramsay making of the moment something permanent, as, in another sphere, Lily herself tried to make of the moment something permanent. This was of the nature of a revelation. In the midst of chaos there was shape, this eternal passing and flowing. She looked at the clouds going and the leaves shaking, was struck into stability. "Life stands still here," Mrs. Ramsay said. "Mrs. Ramsay, Mrs. Ramsay," she repeated. She owed it all to her. All was silence. Nobody seemed yet to be stirring in the house. She looked at it there, sleeping in the early sunlight, with its windows green and blue with the reflected leaves. The faint thought she was thinking of Mrs. Ramsay seemed in consonance with this quiet house, this smoke, this fine early morning air. Faint and unreal, it was amazingly pure and exciting. She hoped nobody would open the window or come out of the house, but that she might be left alone to go on thinking, to go on painting. She turned to her canvas. But, impelled by some curiosity, driven by the discomfort of the sympathy which she held undischarged, she walked a pace or two to the end of the lawn to see whether, down there on the beach, she could see that little company setting sail. Down there among the little boats which floated, some with their sails furled, some slowly, for it was very calm, moving away, there was one rather apart from the others. The sail was, even now, being hoisted. She decided that there, in that very distant and entirely silent little boat, Mr. Ramsay was sitting with Cam and James. Now they had got the sail up. Now, after a little flagging and silence, she watched the boat take its way with deliberation past the other boats, out to sea. Chapter 5. The sails flapped over their heads. The water chuckled and slapped the sides of the boat, which drowsed motionless in the sun. Now and then the sails rippled with a little breeze in them, but the ripple ran over them and ceased. The boat made no motion at all. Mr. Ramsay sat in the middle of the boat. He would be impatient in a moment, James thought, and Cam thought, looking at her father, who sat in the middle of the boat between them. James steered. Cam sat alone in the bow, with his legs tightly curled. He hated hanging about. Sure enough, after fidgeting a second or two, he said something sharp to McAllister's boy, who got out his oars and began to row. But their father, they knew, would never be content until they were flying along. He would keep looking for a breeze, fidgeting, saying things under his breath, which McAllister and McAllister's boy would overhear, and they would both be made horribly uncomfortable. He had made them come. He had forced them to come. In their anger, they hoped that the breeze would never rise, that he might be thwarted in every possible way, since he had forced them to come against their wills. All the way down to the beach they had lagged behind together, though he bade them, "Walk up," without speaking. Their heads were bent down, their heads were pressed down by some remorseless gale. Speak to him they could not. They must come, they must follow, they must walk behind.